This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, well, we're going to get straight to the questions. Dear doctors, I feel like I'm in the process of losing my best friend. She's been trying to leave an emotionally abusive, narcissistic relationship with a much older man for a while. She's 31, he's 67. Until very recently, I was giving everything I had in the tank to convince her to leave this man, promising to even send her thousands of dollars to make the cross-country move. I have even helped to set her up as a freelancer, and she has proven that she can make a steady, albeit humble, income doing so. Still, she seems unwilling to leave him for a variety of complicated reasons. While on the one hand I'm trying to continue being kind and understanding of her shtick, another part of me feels completely fed up. I feel like if I continue sticking by her, even though she's wasting her life, I'm almost endorsing how she is choosing to live her life. She's my best friend and means a lot to me. I have no other friends except for my immediate family. But I'm quite frankly at this point where I don't know how this friendship can continue if she is living her life, heeding a set of values that I in no way endorse. Of her own admission, she has no future with this guy. But whenever I try to have this conversation with her, she freezes up and goes silent on me for weeks until she messages again with a complete change in topic. What would you do, doctors, if you were in my position? I feel very sad, but also completely exasperated. Thank you so much for your wisdom.
Well, I can jump in. I've been on both sides of this equation a couple of times. There's a lot of sort of principles that we talk about that are emergent in this question that we can revisit. But I definitely sympathize because I have been the sort of bad decision-making, needy best friend who's not taking the very good, sound advice from another friend. And I have also been the friend who is desperately trying to dispense the advice to make better decisions to a friend who just refuses to do so. So I think this is to some degree a particular feature of adult female friendships. I don't think dudes struggle with this in the same way that women do. Female friendships are sort of a unique animal, and I think women don't often understand that friendship is really, you know, it's an insurance policy. So we've talked about this before. So you're essentially paying the premium on, the content of that friendship by investing your time and energy, listening to their problems and staying up late phone calls and sending messages back and forth and, you know, watching movies together and going out to coffee or whatever you're doing. All of those things are how you're investing over time in that person. And you're doing so at some level strategically because you are investing in them being there for you when you need them. So relationships are all sort of baseline. There's an element of transaction in the way that we talked about last week when we talked about the unconditional love question. And so there's a transactional dimension to friendships as well, which, you know, we sort of forget about. We remember that it's present in work relationships and romantic relationships to some degree when there are qualification issues in particular, but we forget about it in friendship. There's sort of this idea, especially in my experience between women, that, you know, you got to stick by each other through thick and thin, and it's a, you know, friends forever kind of deal. And you're feeling very frustrated that she's not taking your advice because she's not valuing your advice. You've been putting yourself out there again and again and again, trying to really, you know, listening to all of her woes and hearing her talk smack about this guy, you know, telling her, you know, she's telling you that there's no future. She's complaining about him to you, probably because she doesn't have anybody else to complain about him to. And so you are trying to solve the problem for her to make yourself more valuable to her as part of the insurance investment scheme. And just because that's just what friendship is and how it works. And she's not taking your advice. She's essentially just what that reads to your nervous system is that she's not listening to you. And so of course that's going to generate frustration. Of course, at some point the CB on continuing to give her advice that she's just not going to take really runs itself out. And you're really tired of listening to the same song and dance from her. Like, hey, I have this terrible problem. Please help me solve it. And you're giving her perfectly good ways to solve the problem, and she's not taking you up on them. So this is of course it's going to be frustrating. And so you're in a position where this moment of this friendship, it's not to say that there's nothing here that can ever be redeemed and that you two can't be close again, but she's essentially not qualifying to be your friend right now, with this relationship being so central in her life. And there's no, you don't owe her this dogged perseverance of attention and to just continue throwing bad advice or good advice at someone who's not going to take the advice. So it's like it's a bad investment. And so I would just recommend, you know, that this is sort of a we need to come up with a cute term for this because it's not quite ghosting, but just distancing yourself from the situation because she's not going to change her mind and take you up on it. She's running her own CB and we don't know all of the components of that. I can tell you that I have been, when I've been the sort of bad friend on the side of this, I will behave in very similar ways that you were describing her behavior. I will, you know, say things like, oh yeah, I know that there's no future and I know it can never work, because in some sense I'm trying to acknowledge that your efforts are appreciated and understood, and that like I get that you're trying to help me, and so I'm going to give you some status for that. But that doesn't mean that's how she really, clearly it's not how she's really feeling. It's not really what's at the heart of the CB. What's really at the heart of the CB is that she's staying with him for whatever the reasons are. We don't know from this question exactly what all of the dynamics are, but there's some constellation of her own personality features, her own agreeableness, her own lack of probably financial independence, particularly since you're talking about her sort of humble income that she's making freelancing. So she's feeling both hemmed in terms of what other choices she can make in her life. And then she's also, she's continuing to benefit from the relationship in ways that you perhaps are not even privy to, or definitely don't understand for whatever reasons. So she's running her CB. She's trying to kind of manage you because she knows what to expect from you. She knows where you stand. It's very clear where you stand and what you've told her to do and what you believe is the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do. And that's why she's going silent on you. She's probably a fairly agreeable person who, and it's very hard for agreeable people to leave even bad relationships, so keep that in mind, is probably the less agreeable of the two of you. She's struggling with that. And then she is managing you by going silent when she knows that she's going to run up against your essentially your criticism, because you're not approving of the choices that she's making, and she doesn't feel like she is empowered to leave this relationship for whatever reason, either because there's some benefit she's getting from it, or she's too scared to leave, or some combination of those two things. So there's really, you have done, from how this question is laid out, pretty much everything that it sounds like would be reasonable for any friend to do. And I would just, I always am of the feeling that there's very rarely a need to make any big declaration of these things, but you just sort of distance yourself a little bit. And if she squawks about it and complains, like, where are you? Where have you been? Just, you can say something like, I just really feel like this this relationship is a little toxic to my dynamic with you. And, you know, I feel like there's nothing more I can do to help you with it. And until you want my help to make a plan and to do something, then I'm just really, I think I need to take some time and a little distance from our friendship right now. And, you know, just, I'm not severing ties, and I'm here if and when you need my help. But until then, I'm going to let you kind of work this out on your own, because I think you've got stuff that you need to do. And really only have that conversation if it really comes to it and she's pushing you. Otherwise, I don't think that conversation's even necessary. I think you just get a little less responsive, and you just manage your own investment and the level at which you were trying to live her life for her. This is kind of a corollary of the question we had last week or the week before about letting people run their own show, letting children run their own show, letting adults run their own show. It's her life. It's her CB. You've made your role and what you're offering her very clear. And you're not taking that away from her if she wants to take you up on it, but you're not going to try to just beat your head against the wall and offer her help that she doesn't want at this point. So that's how I would generally approach that.
Wonderful. Dr. Lyle, what say you?
Do you have anything else to add to that? Yeah.
No, all good, comprehensive, perfect.
All right. Well, that was easy.
Yeah. Here we go.
Okay.
All
right. What's next for us?
All right. Dear doctors, I have a question regarding alien abductions. I once read a book called Communion, which is an alien abductee's accounts of being abducted over several years. In this book, he also detailed other people's experiences. John E. Mack, the former head of psychiatry at Harvard, where Jen went to college, did a decade-long study on 200 alien abductees and did not find any obvious pathologies present across the study subjects. If mental illness is not to account for the feeling of being abducted by aliens, what are the doctor's takes on this strange phenomenon?
How classic. Some guy in a department of psychiatry is going to do some worthless study so he can get on a tabloid front page. This is, you know, he did a decade-long study of 200 people that claim this, like this is something interesting. What a total waste of time. All we're obviously talking about here is some degree of extroversion, obviously high openness, probably not very high conscientiousness, and probably not very smart. So if we took the average IQ of the average abductee, there's a good chance it's below the mean. So because if your stupid friends just might believe you and give you a little status for it. So no, I wouldn't expect any psychopathology out of this. I just expect some rather run-of-the-mill, nonsensical humans that believe in all kinds of crazy shit. That's what I think.
Wonderful.
Yeah. That's what that is. I mean, what a ridiculous thing for this guy to do. I mean, really? How many people do you need to study before you figure out that these are just a bunch of low-end, not very smart whack jobs, that there's nothing wrong with them? Just do 10. Let's not spend a decade and do 200. What a fool. All right. But really what it was grandstanding, because it was the sexiest thing that this guy could sell at a conference. That's what drove that. Whenever you can't figure out something, why somebody's doing something, look for status. And that's what that research was. All right.
All
wonderful.
Right. Yeah.
I take it you don't believe in aliens.
No. Or alien abductions, nor do I believe that the people thought that they were abducted.
Right. I mean, that's really Occam's razor answer to this question is that's what they have in common is that they were all actually abducted. Right? Like, let's just consider the obvious hypothesis.
Right.
Like, let's just take them at their word.
Yeah,
why
sure.
Wouldn't we?
Right. And despite, you know, the amazing thing is about that is that, like, all of the radar work that we do and the motivation for the aliens, obviously what the aliens wanted to do was they wanted to come and not talk to any of our heads of government, heads of military, heads of science, or anything else. No, they wanted to talk to 200 morons. That's who they wanted to talk to. And otherwise leave no sign. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anybody that it would say it is an idiot, and anybody that believes it is an idiot, and anybody that studies it is an idiot. The whole thing is... Total fiasco.
Dr. Lyle, what do you think about the movie Independence Day? That one was pretty
good. That's a good movie. That's a good movie.
It's totally basically a documentary.
All right.
Oh, man.
All good.
Well, I know better than to try to weigh in on that question when Doug's in that much of a rant about something feeling that disagreeable.
Oh, so your mystic chip is,
Well, yeah, I think it's coming down to openness. It's going to openness,
sure.
and status opportunity.
Sure.
Not only, you know, the author of the study and the paper and his own status mongering, but also, yeah, the, you know, Doug's touching on it, the sort of low hanging fruit of social status available to the local yokel who gets to go into the bar and tell a story about being abducted. So,
oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
I would do it myself.
Yeah. It's just tall tales, you know, like control for people, like who's most likely to tell a tall tale in general. Yeah. It's going to be all of those characteristics that you're talking about with a dose of, again, the sort of the extroversion to go weave a tale in a social setting about it to gain a bunch of status. So, yeah. But he's the head of psychiatry, so he's not thinking about the world this way. I also just, you know, since I've been tarnished by my association.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Want to state for the record that I don't, you know, was not part of that department and don't know the guy and don't completely have no knowledge of any research or any work that he's done and have nothing to do with my Harvard experience. So
there you go. There you go. You're clean.
Got to defend myself here.
All right. All right. What else?
Our next question. This listener actually has it right.
Yeah.
And she starts with saying, "Dear doctors, especially Dr. Hawk."
Oh, well, thank God.
There we go.
"Dear doctors, especially Dr. Hawk, I've been struggling with mood swings, PMS, my whole life now. However, they've gotten worse over the past few months since I seem to let out my frustration on my partner now. I really try not to take it out on him while I'm PMSing, but I simply can't stop myself from obsessing over my exaggerated feelings and emotions. I feel like I need so much more attention and signs of love that it makes it kind of hard and almost impossible for my partner to treat me right during this period. Small mistakes like not messaging or calling me back on time make me furious, and when he tries to apologize, I tend to stonewall him and twist his every word so that I get even angrier. I'd really appreciate some tips on how to get along with my significant other during this special time and get some advice on how not to obsess over one's emotions."
PMS.
The question
that sounds like yours.
For me is the PMS question. Yeah, well, yeah, sort of irrational rage with PMS is definitely, I think, an experience a lot of women share. And I think what you're seeing here is you're saying that it's gotten worse as you've been taking it out on him more recently, but I think you're probably seeing I have a good friend who says this about my own PMS, that it's the only 2 days a month that I'm actually really myself, and the rest of the time I'm like in I'm holding it together with the agreeable facade. And so you're more in a position of power in that relationship if you've been together for a while, and so you're letting you're more freely expressing your rage during your neediness and all of the other like high emotions that you're having at this time. So I don't think it's that you're experiencing worse symptoms than you were before, but you're more prone to voicing them and asking him to acknowledge them in a particular way. So that's the first place I would start there. So I think you're just generally more in a position of power in the relationship, and so your emotions are more likely to bubble up in their true form, and you're going to share more of them, and you're going to make more demands on your partner. So it's not that you're getting worse or that there's anything wrong with you. You're just feeling more secure in your relationship, and your true self is coming out to play a little bit. So, this is just a completely common experience. So I would give you the general toolkit that I give most people around anything resembling sort of emotional instability. which it sounds like you're probably somewhere on the, you know, not extremely emotionally unstable, but you're on the right side of the curve if you're having symptoms like this and they're getting worse around that time of the month where you're really having trouble modulating your moods and you're you know, really prone to exaggerating things both for good and ill. You're probably just a less stable human. And it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, for you to change that. So you're a reactive human, just like, you know, cats. There, anybody who's lived with cats, usually if you have multiple cats in the household, one of them is nowhere to be seen when people show up at the door. And the other one's coming out and looking for pets and socializing, and the other one skitters off and goes and hides under the bed and you don't see it for 3 days. It's just these are the individual differences in the emotional stability inherent to any particular creature. And you're more of a skittish, reactive human. And so just like you can't really train that cat to not be afraid when somebody shows up at the door, no matter how many times somebody comes by, just because that's how it's built, you're probably always going to experience this high degree of emotional reactivity and the obsession and the demands on your partner and all this kind of stuff that's bubbling up around this time. You're not gonna stop that from happening. This is just kind of who you are, and as long as you're gifted with womanhood and during your moon time, you're gonna have this kind of experience. So I tend to think of the best way to work with this is sort of retrospectively. Preventative and retrospectively. So I would sit down with your partner and explain personality and big five and individual differences and how you're a little less of a stable person. You're over here on the bell curve, and that makes you just more dynamic and exciting. And part of that means that you're more prone to this really high degree of negative emotionality around this particular time of month, more so than usual. And so this is something to be expected. And then you recruit him as a co-conspirator in that. Like you really just you're asking him to, you know, one of the terms that comes from psychodynamic thinking and all kinds of wooey stuff, but that I actually like a little bit and I will use with people, is to create a container for this kind of moment in your relationship. So you're really asking him to partner with you in this process because you can't change who you are. You're not going to suddenly tamp down these emotions and make them go away. You're asking him to understand that they're emerging for a reason and that they're more exaggerated around this time of the month than at other times. And so, you know, can he be present for you for that? Can he sort of, you know, not take it as literally and seriously at that time because it's a passing storm? And then also use it retrospectively after you've had a big blowout, after you've accused him of not responding to your texts quickly enough, and just sit down with him and say, I was insane earlier and I'm really sorry. And I couldn't be present in my emotions and I was just in a hyper elevated state and I really apologize. And can we just reset things? And so as long as you're retaining that mindfulness around your own behavior and you've set the expectations accordingly, and he's sufficiently over rewarded that he's not going to run away when you have crazy emotionality, which it doesn't sound like he's too worried about that. Sounds like he's sticking around, then those are kind of the best ways to try to deal with this problem, because you're asking the question, like, how to not obsess over your emotions. Like, this is just what you're doing. This is who you are and how you're built. And it's going to vary at different times in the month, like it will for most women. So it's really just about engineering the relationships that you have to accommodate that rather than trying to change who you fundamentally are.
Wonderful. Dr. Lyle, what do you want to touch this at all?
I mean, all great. The I would say all of that makes a great deal of sense to me. One possible little technique that might be suggested to her husband would be to during that time to flood your circuit. So so again, Jen is painting a picture where they're co-conspirators. It's the two of them against the fact that we've got a raging storm of neurons, okay?
Yeah, and you are not the problem.
Right.
The storm is the problem, and you're in it together.
You're right. Yeah. Beautifully, beautifully conceived. And so the notion here is that one thing that can, what we see is that we can see inside from this kind of turbulence sort of what the goals are and the important features are of the human organism, in this case, the woman in a relationship. In other words, probably the biggest concern is, am I secure in the relationship? Like, it isn't like whether or not the apples that got delivered, you know what I mean, are tasty or not. No, the issue is my relationship, my husband, whether I'm secure, whether I'm wanted, whether or not, you know, the fact that I'm turbulent now and upset, yeah, my upsettedness is actually causing the very problem that it is that I'm very desperate to try to solve, which is to try to be more interpersonally attractive and therefore worth it and therefore get good feedback and therefore be secure. So it's a very sort of frustrating firestorm. And one of the ways to combat this is for the man to basically hug you and whisper in your ear and say, you know, you're the most important person in my world. I love you to death, and you are invited and included in everything in my life. And essentially, we're flooding that person's nervous system. We're speaking right down to the source code. The source code is abandonment, anxiety. That is the source code of the situation. So we want to speak in as clear and heavy-handed English that we can, and physically, which with the hugging, and right up to the ear where it's super intimate, that it's basically from my mind to yours, this is what's inside my mind. And that flooding of the circuits literally, in my personal history with this, has been that this is this sort of behavior, this sort of technique, is worth, you know, more than 5 hours of careful dissection and argument and careful, you know, analysis of why everybody's upset. In other words, we go right down into the source code and we soothe that organism that at a primal level is very, very anxious and upset. So that's a piece to this puzzle that we can add depending on if the personalities can handle it and it works. But I would offer that as a not only as a specific technique for this situation, but a more generic technique is when there's issues in relationships, we try to identify the source code threat and try to speak as directly and forcefully and effectively to that issue as possible. And that is the best leverage we have against these kind of problems.
I remember telling somebody, you're invited and included. And I had to say that 3 times. I was like, you're invited, you're included, come on. And then they got even more upset.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is a real personality-dependent question as well, because like if somebody did that to me, if I was really upset, I would feel a little patronized. It would be, like, depending on the circumstances, but the flooding the like attribute anecdote flooding the circuits would work. Like, in other words, if you get really specific about why I'm invited and included, and it's like really sort of like you're gonna get really, really directly specific about all the ways that I am valued and included, then it's like, okay, all right, then we can work with that. But just the sort of the generally being told would not do it for me if I was really highly, highly elevated in that particular abandonment fugue.
But interesting.
I think it's gonna vary a lot depending on different women and their PMS experience.
Sure. Worth a shot.
Sure, totally worth a shot. And again, it's like giving him, like, he, because he mostly, you know, with his male mind, wants to fix the problem fundamentally. And so the worst thing, as Doug is alluding to, the worst thing most men are going to do in this situation is to rationalize it and you know, pick it apart and be like, but I didn't say that. I said this, and this is how it went. And like, no, don't do that. And so enlisting him and explaining to him that, you know, he has this impulse to fix it, but that's really probably not what you need need most in the moment because you recognize that you were escalated and somewhat irrational, that you know, you can communicate to him. You can give him the tools that are going to work best and empower him with those to help him feel like he's more on board with this the two of you against the problem routine. So whatever that is for you, whether it's the source code, you know, abandonment swaddle, or if it's something mm-hmm. a little more specific that's sort of encompassing more of the rational approach, then whatever that particular blend is, I think you'll find some equilibrium.
All right, our next question, which is kind of in a similar topic, is what's the deal, dear doctors? What is the deal with anger management? Dr. Doug Lyle has spoken before about how anger is a response to a perception of unfairness. Would this basically mean that if you're angry but not getting your way, all you can do is distance yourself from the situation and people, or gather more information and understand if your anger is potentially unfounded? I guess I'm in a situation where I feel very angry and confident that I'm right, but it feels awful. Is time the only way to get over it?
Well, this person is sort of asking an interesting question, but with the specifics are always critical here. So hard to answer whether time will fix this or not. The answer is maybe not. Depends upon what the circumstances are and what's happening. Now, the anger is an instinct, and so it's an instinct to signal other people that have done something. It is the first thing it is. It's an indication of conflict of interest between you and some entity. It might be your computer screen, which is behind that is the designer of the screen and the manufacturer and the salesman and everything else. So in other words, if you're angry, it's between you and another organism with a consciousness. And so that's how, you know, the fact that you might actually be pissed off at your cell phone is—it's not the cell phone; it's the people that you have an implied contract with that is supposed to work. And when it's not working, they're violating the contract by your estimation. So anger is an instinct that's designed to have an impact on the person who is the target of that anger. So it's designed to signal to them that you believe that you've been treated unfairly. Now, you may be very irritated with somebody and not signal to them because you have enough other savvy. You're a complicated machine, and you realize that may not be in your best interest. Okay, so part of the process is probably informing your own nervous system that it's the feelings actually are a global informing process to essentially activate all kinds of other circuits around the brain to alert it as to what's happening and then to start working on the solution. So the problem is I'm not being treated fairly according to my estimation of what's fair, and the anger is an instinct to threaten the individual or individuals on the other side of that with some kind of a penalty. That they're going to a price that they're going to pay if they continue to block the goal that they're blocking of yours. So quote, do we just get over it? Well, a lot of times we do because at the moment there is some values on the line and they are blocking them in a way that we feel is unfair, and so it activates the anger instinct. But the anger instinct, even if we share it with them and threaten them, they may push back. They may penalize us further. They may do nothing about it. In other words, they may basically shrug their shoulders and say, "Too bad, that's the negotiation, and you're out of luck. And no, I don't want to date you." That's that. Okay. In other words, whatever it is, they have their own perception of what's fair and what isn't fair, and those two perceptions may conflict indefinitely. And as long as the value is on the line and it represents goals of the individuals involved, it would continue to activate the anger mechanism. So so it depends upon, you know, the notion that time heals all wounds. It depends upon what the wound is, what's causing it, and whether the circumstances involved have actually passed. Now, the person's alluding to some good thinking in terms of how it is that you get over it. So one of the ways you do it is you back up and you try to understand precisely why it is that you believe that they're being unfair and why it is that you think that you've been aggressed against. And then you want to think about the safest and most effective ways that you might try to address that unfairness. At the end of the day, a lot of times the anger is going to fade because the CB on it is no longer worth it. In other words, we've already determined that we can't push them around with our anger. We can't guilt them into making changes. And so therefore, the nervous system basically says, we've lost this fight. And it's not worth generating this system in order to keep informing us of this, because it's not likely to be successful. Very much similar to, you've got an exciting new possibility for a job, but after they turn you down, you're depressed about it and unhappy about it. But then you aren't excited about when you see their ad in the paper again, because that opportunity is not going to be for you. So that's how this is going to work. Ultimately, if we're really irritated and we're continually irritated, it's because we are in some kind of a position of weakness with respect to whatever this whatever the resource it is that they are blocking, and from our perception, blocking unfairly. And so from my point of view, that if we're in a position of weakness, we're in a position of weakness. The only way to start to maneuver your mind around the problem is to understand that you can get to a position of power, but in this particular instance, you're going to lose. And so what you're going to lose is you're going to lose some resources. You're going to lose some time and energy. That's what's going to happen. You may lose some status. They may have taken credit for something that you did, and you can't guilt them into changing it. And therefore, you're in a situation where, that's kind of too bad. And so what you want to do is you want to look at circumstances like this where there was something important that was activating the anger mechanism, and there wasn't anything you could do to get even. And you want to back up and you want to say, how did I get myself into the situation where I was in a position of weakness where I could have been exploited? Okay, what were the circumstances that led to me making those choices and having that situation vis-a-vis that individual? And it could be that you flew to some third world country at the wrong time, and now you got a conflict of interest with the military junta, and now you're in trouble. Okay, and yeah, you're angry because you're an American citizen. You should be treated differently, but you're not being treated differently. So what did you do to put yourself under those circumstances? So think through, if you ever lose something major and you're really hot about it, it does make sense to back up, think through all the angles, and to understand that for whatever set of circumstances, probably quite reasonable, that you made assumptions that your position and your value flow from this relationship was safe, and it turned out that it wasn't. And that's an important lesson. If you ever lose big, the most important thing you do is don't lose the lesson. So keep in mind that we are often in situations where we can be upset like this because we are feeling that we're in positions of weakness. And what we take out of those when we lose is, make sure that we file that away and the concept away for next time. It isn't just that specific individual that needs a red marker for your memory. It's also the entire process by which you got yourself into that. That also needs some analysis if the loss was substantive enough. So that's the story on anger and its processing.
Wonderful, Dr. Lyle.
All right.
Our final question for this evening. Dear Dr. Lyle, dear Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge to help people. It's much appreciated. I was glad to see Jordan Peterson is doing so much better after recovering from his physical dependencies on benzodiazepines. I think many people were surprised he turned to benzos, given his knowledge as an evolutionary psychologist. Would you be able to explain what makes people desperate enough to seek anti-anxiety drugs, and what could be done from an evolutionary psychology point of view instead to reduce stress and anxiety and avoid resorting to medication?
Well, we this could be a joint, but let me just give a few things off the top, and Jen, you just pile in as we go around this. One thing is to understand that a useful thing to understand from an evolutionary point of view is that anxiety is a reaction to the fact that you're being threatened. And so one thing that you can do is you can figure out what that threat is and then move yourself. So one of the beautiful metaphors that Jen has come up with is the notion that you think of yourself as a potted plant, for goodness sakes. Don't try to fix yourself. Try to change your environment so that the environment fits you. So if you're in situations that are causing you a great deal of anxiety, the thing to do in principle isn't to figure out how to medicate or change yourself somehow. The situation is to change the informational inputs that are hitting your nervous system that are causing the anxiety. So I would have told the guy to, long since, to hang it up and go to Bora Bora, take some of your success and just go freaking chill on an island for a couple of months and shut off the cell phone. That would have been a really good idea. But in principle, that's my notion, is to think about what inputs are hitting the circuits that are causing it. And of course, there's many reasons why he would have blown past any reasonable stop sign just because he had such enticing CBs in order to keep in the public eye. So, Jen, thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, as the kids say, I stan Jordan Peterson. So I'm a pretty big fan, and I followed him pretty closely. And so I happen to know sort of a little bit more about the story of his turn toward benzos is less about the pressure of being in the public eye, and more about his wife's diagnosed terminal illness. So basically his wife was sent home to die by a bunch of experts that they consulted with, some rare cancer, and that there was really nothing to be done. And so that was, I think, the proximate, that was what got him into the benzos, but he was primed for it, I think, by his sort of ridiculous ascendancy that he is not, as a personality, really prepared for. I think we've talked before about sort of who Jordan Peterson is, Big Five wise, and he's extremely conscientious, fairly disagreeable, and pretty highly unstable. And that combination of things, I think he has a very hard time taking on criticism, and he has a very hard time just letting things go in general, letting things kind of slide, especially. And when you reach the level of fame as quickly as he did, from decades of living a relatively quiet life as a cherished professor at with a cult following at the University of Toronto that a small number of people knew about and really valued, and a lot of status in that sort of village that he had established for himself, into this national stage, international stage, with a ridiculous number of trolls and people coming at him from all directions with all kinds of criticism. I think it was very, very difficult for him to take that on. And even if he had, I mean, he certainly had the resources to take himself off to Bora Bora, but it's not who the guy is. Like, he's a workaholic, conscientious, unstable, like super freak. So he just wasn't going to do it. The story that he tells, if people are interested in kind of catching up on this, and people may not be aware that this is what he went through, but he nearly died, mostly from his attempted withdrawal from his benzo dependency, and his family wound up taking him to Russia, which was the only place that they could find sort of experimental treatment that put him in a coma for some lengthy amount of time to allow him to detox without the detox symptoms that were almost worse than the addiction itself, that was making it impossible for him to detox in Canada or in the States. So I don't know all of the exact details, but his daughter just interviewed him on her podcast, and so people can watch that or listen to that for the details. And he's definitely still, he's not totally out of the woods. Like, he's doing better, but it's still pretty rough. So and the other thing I would add is that the question is saying, you know, given his knowledge as an evolutionary psychologist, I would not classify him as an evolutionary psychologist. He is evolutionary psychology adjacent, and he borrows a lot of concepts. And you know, some of them are very useful, the way that he talks about things and approaches problems. But he's got a lot of noise in there too. He's like half evolutionary, half Jungian. And there's a lot of spiritual, mystical weirdness, which was part of why I always found him very appealing.
Right. But he makes sense.
He, by his own admission, in that interview with Michaela, he basically does not, the version of the story he tells is that he didn't realize that benzos had such a high, that they were, the addiction was so likely.
Quality.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he really thought that this was just totally standard medication just to manage. Like, I think he just wanted to get some sleep. I think he was having trouble sleeping. And so he's become now a real advocate against them, and very strongly in that interview says, you know, people need to know that this is, you know, very high addiction rate, really difficult to get off of them if you're on them for any amount of time, even, I think, you know, a week.
Two weeks. Two weeks is enough to put you in a serious trap.
Yeah, and it happens to, you know, a vast majority of people who do it. So I think he's come around, but he just didn't know. He just didn't know. He was in the sort of conventional psychology world that was like, well, this is a tool to manage anxiety, and so why wouldn't we use it if we're going through a really hard time? Like, it's not, you're not going to get addicted. Only addicts get addicted. And he's just, you know, had his foot in that paradigm. He doesn't, you know, he's not really a clinical psychologist either. He's a professor, and he's, you know, he has some clinical experience and he has a practice, but really fundamentally, he's an academic and a professor and an author and sort of public figure. So he just didn't know, and he got himself in the trap and nearly died. So, I am glad that he didn't. There was, you know, some scuttlebutt on Twitter for months, like, did Michaela just, you know, did she take her dad to Russia and kill him? And, you know, she's now like tweeting for him, and, you know, where's like free Jordan Peterson hashtag. So that he's now been seen, but you can tell, like, if you follow him, that he's not at full recovery by any means. He's definitely low energy, still pretty stressed, still not doing that well. So did a lot of damage.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only was he not informed, but neither was his psychiatrist, which is what makes Robert Whittaker a hero. So that's why our people need to know that Anatomy of an Epidemic is a tremendous document. It's well worth your read, even if you don't have anything to do. You know, just if you're of the next 20 books that you're going to read in this life, even if you don't have anybody that you even know or have any interest in psychiatric meds, Anatomy of an Epidemic is, just from the sheer standpoint of world history and also the nature of medicine and misinformation and et cetera, it's a phenomenal story. Well worth your read. And unfortunately, these guys didn't know.
I was just going to say, well, the second part of the question was about, you know, what if not benzos, then what? Then what do you do? How do you manage anxiety? But it points to sort of the limitations of his own nervous system in ways that we talk about all the time. Like, he's a very anxious nervous system. He's and it's why his only strategy really is to control his environment, maybe not by escaping to a tropical island, but by techniques that, you know, we've talked about in other cases, where it's like, don't look at your YouTube comments, dude. Like, you know, you really, really need to really control the level of information that's coming into your world and who you're dealing with. Sorry about that. But so he really, more than most people, he's got to really control who he's hanging out with, what he's reading, you know, just as much as possible. He's never going to be able to completely turn off and shut down and escape, but he can outsource, and people with that personality can outsource the management of the most anxiety causing things in their lives to other people, particularly someone with resources like he has. Like, just have someone else read your email, you know, have someone else manage your social media accounts and all of that. So, yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.